I'm talking about this subject. And the work I'll be discussing is a collaboration still in progress with Demopoulos, Koper, Lawrence, and Silverstein. The collaboration has a few different goals, and so I'll be talking about the aspects of it that deal with supersymmetry breaking, and later this morning, Eva Silverstein will talk about some different aspects of the same work. So let me begin by motivating what we're going to talk about in this talk. I think it's fair to say that for many years, between about 1985 and 1995, there was a common expectation in the string theory community, for at least from those who thought about such matters, that the way string theory might eventually make contact with nature is that nature would be some particular realization of the E8 cross E8 heterotic string, or perhaps SO32, compactified it on a Calabi-Yau threefold, so there'd be n equals one supersymmetry at a high scale in four dimensions.
Can you move your microphone to the mic?
Is that better? Good. So in such a scenario, where nature is related to the E8 cross E8 heterotic string, one E8 serves as a nice home for the standard model. And then the hidden E8 could serve various purposes, like, for instance, serving as a sector where supersymmetry is broken. And then gravitational mediation using four-dimensional gravity could communicate that to us at a nice low scale like a TEV. And in light of the work of Rojava and Witten, a close relative of this scenario still survives as a very, very promising construction in string phenomenology. Where now, of course, we know there's an 11th dimension, and at finite coupling, we should think of the heterotic string as really having this extra small interval. And the two E8s live on the ends of the interval, and we could imagine that we're living on one of these ends, and that perhaps the hidden E8 and maybe supersymmetry breaking is occurring over here on the other end, and the geometries that arise have basically an interval in between, sometimes with a mild warping. Now, the oldest scenarios, the first ones I talked about, had a 10 metric, the solution of string theory, that was just Minkowski space plus a six-dimensional piece, which is basically the Ricci flat metric on the Calabi-Yau K, as long as it was large enough. And that's not exactly true, but that was a very good approximation in most of the studies that were performed. Okay. And in the Rojava-Witten case, as I mentioned, this isn't quite true. We add an interval, there's mild warping. But in many applications, this is, it's a reasonable thing to say that the geometry is not very warped. Now, more recently, on the other hand, it has been realized that really rich new physical ideas, conceptually new ideas, emerge if you study strings in more general backgrounds, where the metric, instead of looking like this, takes a warped form. So our 10-dimensional manifold could be Minkowski space with some F squared prefactor that depends on some internal coordinates that we don't see. And then these internal coordinates parameterize some compactification manifold K. And naturally, as you all know, the most prominent new examples of such things, and I put new in quotes, they're not so new, come from either the duality between anti-de Sitter spaces and conformal field theories, or their close relatives, which are the Randall-Sundrum scenarios. So let me quickly remind you about that. In those scenarios, to start with, we can ignore most of the extra dimensions of string theory. Let's just work in the five dimensions of ADS5. Okay? So you can take a five metric that looks like this, where eta is the Minkowski metric, mu and nu run from 0 to 3. And we have an exponential warping of the Minkowski metric as one moves in the x5 direction. And if you take x5 to live on the entire interval between minus infinity and infinity, then this is one view of ADS5 in Poincaré coordinates. And via the ADS-CFT correspondence, and in particular the UVIR correspondence studied by many authors, infrared physics in the field theory, in the four-dimensional field theory that you get by trying to ignore the x5 direction, is somehow related to gravity in the region where the warp factor is quite small, where x5 goes to plus infinity, the warp factor vanishes. Well, ultraviolet physics in the field theory is somehow related to the gravitational background in the region where the warp factor is quite large, where x5 goes to minus infinity. Now, in scenarios where one really tries to make a four-dimensional model of physics out of this, one typically chops off the X5 interval somewhere in the ultraviolet, somewhere on the left, okay, as Randall and Sundrum did, and you put what I'll call an ultraviolet brain there, and then they showed that, for instance, a four-dimensional mode of the five-dimensional graviton could be well localized in this area. And also, it's sometimes useful to cut off the ADS at the infrared end also, depending on what kind of dual field theory you're looking at. Such an infrared cutoff brain can be a way of parameterizing new phenomena in the infrared, like a mass gap or any kind of weak coupling field theory phenomena that won't be well described by gravity. So it's sometimes natural to stick in an infrared cutoff brain there. And then because of the exponential warping in the metric, the natural energy scale here, which we might call M4, will be related to the natural energy scale here by an exponential. And it's that precious exponential that people try to make mileage out of. So for natural values of the ADS radius, or its inverse k, and for natural values of the distance between the UV and IR brains r, by natural I mean numbers that are of order 5 or 10, you can generate large hierarchies in the natural scales in this problem, where at one end the natural scale would be M4, and at the other end you could get a scale that's exponentially smaller. Okay. And as pointed out by many authors, this is simply an ADS dual manifestation of normal renormalization group running, but now in the strongly coupled regime of this field theory, where the correct way to think about it is really in terms of the five-dimensional gravity. So that's a quick review of the ideas of Randall and Sundrum, or ADS-CFT, with cutoffs. And one could ask, this has been a caricature with infrared brains and ultraviolet brains placed at points in ADS space with no microscopic construction. How does this kind of thinking fit into string theory? Well, Herman Rolinda made a very interesting suggestion, so I'll sort of review that here because it motivates much of my talk. So let's consider M theory on a Calabi-Yau fourfold, a compactification to three dimensions. Well, it turns out that, as you know, M theory has a three-form C field or a four-form field strength G. And tadpole cancellation for the C field gives you a constraint, first, to my knowledge, discussed by Sethi, Vatha, and Witten, which says that the Euler character of this fourfold should be equal to the number of transverse M2 brains one adds, filling the three dimensions transverse to the fourfold, plus something called the G-flux. So G is this field strength, and you get a contribution to the tadpole from the integral of G wedge G. Now, this is not just an esoteric concern, because generically, the Euler character of the Calabi-Yau is not zero. Usually, well, in many simple examples, it can be quite a large number. And so it's natural to imagine such models with a large number of M2 brains, or with a need to turn on significant G-flux. Now, we were just discussing models in three dimensions, while most of us like to think about four-dimensional theories. But if this Calabi-Yau fourfold X4 is elliptic and has a section, then there exists a procedure called taking the F-theory limit, or if you don't like thinking about F-theory, there exists a way of lifting this to a solution of type 2B string theory. And that yields, as long as you've chosen your G-flux correctly, meaning in a way that won't break the Poincaré invariance of the higher dimensional theory, it will yield a theory with four-dimensional Poincaré invariance. And then the NM2 brains that we added for tadpole cancellation in M theory lift to ND3 brains. And explicit discussion of some such models has been carried out by Dasgupta, Rajesh, and Sethi, and Gukov, Vatha, and Witten, and then many subsequent authors. OK, so now let's get to Rolinda's suggestion. We now have a situation where there are ND3 brains, and N can, as I said, be a number that seems large to many of us, you know, something 10 to the fourth. So you might think about doing 1 over N expansions. And since we've just spent many years studying ADS-CFT, it also occurs that if you're in the right regime, if the dilatant is strong enough so that G squared N is appreciable, you might be able to use ADS-CFT ideas to dualize your picture of this fourfold geometry with transverse three brains. So instead of thinking of, in type 2B, the base of X4 being this green blob with point-like D3 brains transverse to it filling all of space, which would be your weak coupling picture, gravitational back reaction, it was suggested, might turn this picture into something more like this. And I have a hard time drawing it in the flat plane here. But you have the base of X4, which is 6 real dimensional. And then growing out of it, instead of there being point-like three brains, you have little ADS throats attached to each of these sets of three brains. So you could have a throat glued in here, and a throat glued in there, and another one there, one for each of these batches of three brains. Now, as I was saying before, one doesn't really expect all of these throats to be exact ADS throats, because one doesn't really expect all of these low-energy theories to be conformally invariant. Okay, these three brains are interacting in some complicated way with defects on the fourfold and so forth. There's reduced supersymmetry. And one might well expect that in the infrared there will either be a mass gap or some infrared weakly coupled field theory. So one might well want to think about cutting off each of these throats at some infrared brain. The exact physics there isn't well described by such a toy cutoff, but examples of the more microscopic description were discussed by Polchinski and Strassor, or by Klebanov and Strassor, and I'll say more about that later. But for now, we'll be happy with just a toy cutoff infrared brain there. So then our picture would be that in each of these throats, there's an ultraviolet brain, which is where we glue the throat into the Calabi-Yau base, and there's an infrared brain that just parameterizes our ignorance of the infrared physics. So a natural question that one could ask in this context is that, okay, in this fourfold, there could be many such throats, because there's no reason that all the brains should clump on top of each other. So, is there any novel physics or interesting physics involved in the way that such throats communicate with each other? Okay, this would be, a different regime of asking similar questions about Horjava-Witten with the two different walls. So, for instance, let's imagine we have this base of the fourfold here, and we have two throats sticking out in some region, and supersymmetry breaks in one of these throats by some dynamics of that field theory. What do we see if we happen to be living at the end of the other throat? And the first thing to say is that what we see will obviously not just be four-dimensional gravitational mediation of whatever happens over there to us. And the reason that it obviously won't just be four-dimensional gravitational mediation is that in many such pictures, you can imagine doing the following. These fourfolds, these Calabi-Yaus, typically come with many close-string moduli. And so one could imagine that most of the base that lives over here has a volume that's dialed by some Kalor parameter. And the region around these two throats might have some other natural closed-string moduli controlling, for instance, the distance between the throats. And what you could imagine is taking a double scaling limit where you take the volume of the bulk of the Calabi-Yau to infinity while you hold the part of the geometry around these two throats fixed. Okay. And in such a limit, since you had taken this volume to infinity, the four-dimensional Planck mass, of course, goes to infinity. So four-dimensional gravity completely decouples from the problem. Okay. But we find that there are effects that persist in such a limit, so they're not described by four-dimensional gravity mediation. And in fact, even when M4 is finite and as we see it today, they can be larger effects than those of four-dimensional gravity mediation. So this kind of communication that I'm talking about can in some sense be fruitfully thought of as a tunneling of the modes or a sharing of the modes between these two different throats. And that will, the word tunneling especially will be made much more explicit in Eva's talk. But to discuss this more here, I need to simplify a little bit. These fourfolds are complicated objects. And we want to do some calculations. So unfortunately, I'm going to have to go to a much simpler toy model than what I really have in mind. And a toy model that captures some of the details of this kind of physics is the following. We can consider a five-dimensional theory. So what I've drawn here is the x5 dimension running along the horizontal. And we have a UV brain, which is supposed to represent, if you want, all of our ignorance about the Calabi-Yau fourfold and its physics. And then we have infrared brains on both sides. Okay, these are supposed to represent the two different throats. And this black line is drawing the warp factor of an ADS space in each such throat. And a priori, they have different ADS radii L1 and L2, and different lengths R1 and R2. And it would be, of course, important to keep track of how these different things enter in any calculations. But for simplicity today, I'm going to set R1 and R2 and L1 and L2 equal to each other, just so notation doesn't get complicated. So the precise question I'll ask about here is what does happen in that toy picture I drew if, for instance, we live on one of those throats and supersymmetry breaks in the other one. what would we see, and how does it differ from other things we're more familiar with? Okay, so to answer that question, we have to compare two different calculations. In the first, we start with just a single throat theory, something that looks like a cutoff ADS, with a bulk scalar phi that's massless, say, and its superpartners, so a five-dimensional hypermultiplet of such stuff. And we explicitly break supersymmetry by adding a five-dimensional mass for the scalar, but not its superpartners, and then do KK reduction on the x5 direction and compute the splittings in four dimensions. That's one calculation one could imagine doing, and that would be what I call sort of supersymmetry breaking in our throat, at least in the bulk of our throat. Now, another calculation you can imagine that's distinct is you look at this toy model of the two-throat geometry, and instead of adding a mass for this bulk scalar everywhere, you have a bulk scalar field living everywhere, but you add a mass that's a step function. So it has a mass in the left throat, but not the right throat. So supersymmetry is broken here, but not here, explicitly, by the step function mass. And then what you do is you compute the splittings over here in this scenario and compare to the splittings over here. So let's just start doing these calculations. They're quite simple. To do the first calculation, what do we have to do? We're studying a scalar field in a background metric that's ADS-like on an interval between 0, which is where the UV brain is, and R, which is where the infrared brain is. So the scalar wave equation is just the standard thing with the curved space Laplacian that appears there. And M0 is this supersymmetry breaking mass. And if we now make the ansatz that we're looking for four-dimensional modes of a definite mass mu squared, so we solve the Kluze-Klein equation in four dimensions with some mass mu squared, and if we define some rescaled variables phi hat and we move to conformal coordinates z, then this equation just becomes this equation for phi hat, some second-order differential equation as a function of z. And our goal is then to find the allowed values of mu for which this equation has solutions. So you find the KK spectrum in four dimensions. So if one stares at that equation and massages it a little bit more by simply performing a change of variables, so you define a new variable x in terms of these conformal coordinates, and you rescale phi hat yet again to give you something called psi, okay, then it turns out that psi satisfies Bessel's equation. And this is, I'm sure, standard for those of you who've worked on ADS-CFT. So, well, the solutions of the bulk wave equation for psi are just Bessel functions and Neumann functions. Recall that the Neumann function is just a linear combination of Bessel functions, which diverges near the origin. And the index of these Bessel and Neumann functions is given by something that's 2 in the supersymmetric limit for us, and otherwise differs by being square root of 4 plus m0 squared. So then just imposing your standard boundary conditions for the scalar at the UV and infrared brains. These are the same kind of boundary conditions that are imposed in all this literature on RS. And solving for the allowed four-dimensional KK masses mu, one finds a spectrum that looks basically like the following. The masses go like 1 over the ADS radius, not surprisingly, times an exponential, e to the minus kr, which is the warp factor at the low scale end of the ADS throat. And so there's this basic k e to the minus kr for the masses, then there's the number of order 1. There's some constant times nu, okay, which is again something basically of order 1, but this is where there's m0 dependence in this formula. And then there's a tower, so there's some other number of order 1 times n, where n is 0, 1, 2, dot, dot, dot. So it follows from that simple calculation that if you assume that the supersymmetric limit is where the scalar mass vanishes in bulk, okay, then the four-dimensional mass splittings for these bulk Kaluza-Klein modes in one throat go like the difference between nu and 2 times k e to the minus kr. Okay, and there's some number of order 1 multiplying that. Now, that's, of course, the splittings in bulk. If we imagine that there are extra fields living on some wall, like at the infrared brain, you have to do a simple calculation to find the induced splitting on the brain fields due to the fact that they're coupling to bulk fields with these splittings. Okay. That last step of computing the wall splittings is something that would be the same in both this and the next calculation, So I'll just discuss it briefly once after the next calculation. So now we should contrast this calculation I just completed with what you might call tunneling-mediated supersymmetry breaking, which is this case where you have the two throats, and you have a scalar mass that breaks supersymmetry that's non-zero in one and that vanishes in the other. Now, of course, all the calculations in bulk will be identical to what I was discussing before. You again get Bessel and Neumann functions as a solution of your bulk equations. But now you have to glue together both the left and right sides at the UV brain. So on the left, since M naught, the supersymmetry breaking mass, doesn't vanish, you get J nu and Y nu, where nu is here. On the right-hand side, where you haven't explicitly broken supersymmetry, you have a J2 and a Y2. And you impose the boundary conditions at the left and right infrared brains and at the ultraviolet brain that match these Bessel functions to each other. And you again find some transcendental equation that you can solve for a discrete spectrum. And the upshot of this is that compared to the previous splittings of bulk modes delta mu that I discussed in the previous transparency, what you find in this case, in calculation 2, is that the splittings of bulk modes are in this right throat down from the scale of supersymmetry breaking in the single throat case by a factor of e to the minus kr. Okay? So if you want, this is the fact that the knowledge about supersymmetry breaking from the left throat has to make its way through the UV brain over to the right. So this delta mu 2 is the splitting of KK modes of bulk fields in this right well now. And then there's the last step one has to deal with, which is transmission to the wall. So suppose we're living at the infrared wall on the right, and supersymmetry was broken in the left well. Well, so then say there are bosons and fermions, phi wall and lambda wall, that we know about. And in addition, there are these bulk fields, phi bulk and lambda bulk. Then the question you should ask is, at what level do bulk splittings translate to splittings for brain localized matter that could be on these infrared brains? Well, if you just assume an effective field theory with generic quartic and Yukawa couplings, which seems reasonable, then what you find is there are, of course, diagrams that look like this that give you mass shifts for the scalar phi on the wall. The divergences cancel, but since supersymmetry is broken, there is a finite residue. And taking that finite residue from each exchange of modes and summing over the KK tower yields a very naive estimate. It's naive both because the sum is actually hard to perform explicitly and for various other reasons, but the naive estimate is that the splittings on the wall go like this, where M5 is the effective 5D Planck mass, L is the ADS radius, and this is an exponential factor, a suppression. And the fact about this answer is that there just does exist a wide range of parameters for which R, L, and M5 are physically reasonable. For instance, M5 can be 10 to the 15 GeV, and this effect is much more significant than four-dimensional gravity mediation. Okay, so that just demonstrates that the computation that's performed in 5D gravity here isn't one that would be easily stated in four-dimensional gravity language, though there should be a good four-dimensional effective field theory involving exchange of other modes. Let me just close by discussing several important questions. One is, about this whole subject, can one make actually very concrete models of, for instance, Calabi-Yau fourfold compactifications, where, for instance, the UV brain is the Calabi-Yau, as I've been saying here, but the infrared brains, instead of being represented in this caricaturish way, are dually represented by choices of G-flux through certain cycles in the Calabi-Yau, which might be degenerating. Okay? So the reason that this seems like a reasonable possibility is that, in, for instance, the solutions of Klebanov and Strasser, who are studying gauge theories that have an RG cascade and do generate large scales, at the end of the day, the dual gravity solution is simply a Calabi-Yau geometry with some small cycles and some G flux. Or, well, it's lift to F theory, which is H and H prime flux, NS flux, and RR three-form flux. Now, using known results about these fourfolds, for instance, the superpotential for complex structure moduli in the presence of G flux is just the 4-0 form wedged with G integrated over the Calabi-Yau. This was derived by Gukov, Waffa, and Witten. it should be possible to actually choose g-fluxes to get this Clebanov-Strassler kind of behavior, and then solve for the complex structure moduli, which are presumably stabilized in the presence of such fluxes. And you should be able to explicitly see the existence of the hierarchy in the fact that some of these moduli will be stabilized at exponentially differing values. Okay. And the reason, of course, that this is possible in such models when it is very difficult to do explicitly in, for instance, old heterotic string models, is simply that in the choices of g-flux or in the choices of these large numbers of brains, discrete fine-tuning is possible. There are large integers to play with. So this is something I've been talking about with Giddings and Bolchinsky. And, well, since I'm almost out of time, just a last thing you could think about is, you know, I was saying that this class of models could be contrasted with the old heterotic string or the newer heterotic string in light of Rojava-Witten. But of course, in the heterotic string, a lot of work has been done really establishing the phenomenological reasonableness of certain heterotic string compactifications. And you could ask, if one takes phenomena like the Susie breaking discussed here seriously, could you really use it in model building? Would it be viable or not? And are there any notable advantages or disadvantages of this 5D gravity regime as compared to normal 4D gauge mediation or gravity mediation or other mediation mechanisms? So that's all I wanted to say, and I think Ivo will talk about other aspects of some more work. Thank you. Okay, so the two cases are the following. In one case, it might be easier if I just show figures. So, good. Here's the geometry that's being discussed, and that black line represents the warp factor. And in one case, what I'm saying is, this is the full geometry. There's just the right picture. You break supersymmetry here explicitly with a mass for a bulk scalar, okay, that splits its supermultiplet. And then you figure out what the supersymmetry breaking looks like in the 4D KK spectrum. And you could calculate the transmission to the wall if you wished. In the other case, you are again interested in the physics on this wall, but instead of breaking supersymmetry here with a mass for a scalar, you break supersymmetry over here with a mass for a scalar, but not explicitly here. And then in mediating the breaking, what has to happen is that, roughly speaking, the modes here, which know directly about supersymmetry breaking, have to sort of get through this UV brain, or what I call tunnel, heuristically. And that tunneling suppression is what gives you an exponential in the relative scales of the supersymmetry breaking. Does that answer your question, Sandeep?
So you got the exponential in the second case, and you didn't get
it. So in the first case, of course, so this is there are different scales in the problem. For a fixed scale of breaking here, lambda, there is an exponential in the second case that damps lambda by an e to the minus 4kr. If you just study the first case alone, there's also an exponential that's related to L1 and R1. That's the normal Randall-Sundrum exponential from this warping. But if you choose L1 and R1 to be small, that's barely an exponential. So it, you know, depending on what your parameters are, they're different exponentials.
Okay. Any other questions?
Have you studied situations where each side is separately separately supersymmetric, but there is a mismatch that breaks supersymmetry?
Good. One of the interesting mechanisms in the heterotic string is a case where for instance, on neither E8 wall is supersymmetry explicitly broken. But what happens is that the supersymmetries that are preserved in space sort of change as you move. And so the whole system does break supersymmetry, though no individual component explicitly does it. And we haven't thought of cases like that here, but of course, with brain constructions in general, that's a very interesting possibility.
I have a question. At the end of your talk, you mentioned that the effect. At the end of your talk, you mentioned the fact that the tunneling mediation, supersymmetry breaking, was larger than gravity mediation. I can understand it with the top of picture, sort of intuitively, but not so much with the lower picture, because there you would think that basically the signal has to go through all the way through the Planck scale anyhow.
The
top picture, you can sort of understand why it gets there more
quickly. The point is that when you match the top picture with the lower picture, the UV scale at this UV brain in the toy model is not the four-dimensional Planck scale. It's the UV scale that would be associated with modes in that little lower circle in the top picture. So it's some scale 1 over L that's related to the 5D gravity setup, and it's not M4.
Okay, because you associate a Newton constant just from the volume of the UV brain, essentially.
Right, and the reason that I think that's the appropriate thing to do there is that, of course, if a mode hops from here to here, and if it's a mode that's localized anyway in this region, as some closed string modes and open string modes are, there's no reason for it to feel this whole Calabi-Yau and to be diffused into the whole volume. So I think in the correct matching of the real picture with the toy model, one should not make the scale with the UV brain related to the four-dimensional Planck scale.
Okay.
Any other questions? Yeah, there's a question.
This is regarding your last point, that is this advantages and disadvantages in realistic model building. Could you please give us some numbers for the low-energy SUSY mass spectrum? I mean, for example, the Gagino ratios of the Gagino masses and...
Okay, as I was saying, this is work in progress. So the extent to which... I can tell you some basic numbers, okay? For instance, I can tell you that if you take M5, which enters in this calculation to be about 10 to the 15 GeV, and if you take L, the ADS radius, to be 10 times the five-dimensional Planck length, and if you take R, the proper distance in this throat, to be 10 times that ADS length, so the gravity regime is fully applicable, then you would get a number out like a TeV for the supersymmetry splittings on the wall. Now, you also asked about Gagino masses, and that brings up an interesting thing that I didn't discuss at all, which is how one accomplishes R-breaking in this kind of situation. And we haven't fully understood that yet, so I don't want to answer it. But I don't claim to know whether this would be phenomenologically viable or not.
If there are no questions, let's thank the speaker.
Okay, couple of announcements about the special lecture program.